Welcome to Let's Talk Social Work. My name is Andy McClanahan, and today my guests and I are discussing the role of independent social workers in the UK and further afield. In Dostoevsky's Notes from the Underground, the narrator states, "What man wants is simply independent choice, whatever that independence may cost and wherever it may lead." With independence comes opportunities as well as risks, and today I'm looking forward to exploring the benefits as well as the costs of stepping out and practicing as an independent social worker. Helping me examine these issues are independent social workers Michelle Strain, Joe Fox and Gareth McGibbon. Welcome to Let's Talk Social Work, Michelle, Joe and Gareth. How are you guys doing? Joe, you first, how are you?
Yeah, over to me. Yeah, I'm doing really well. The wind has stopped here in Cumbria, so peace.
Cumbria, okay, right. Yeah. Yes, northwest of England, isn't that right?
That's right, yeah.
Yes, and then further north, Michelle?
Yeah, I'm in sunny Edinburgh with less wind today as well, yeah.
Okay, well, welcome. Lovely to have you on the podcast. And Gareth, back over my side of the RC. How are you doing?
Just not too bad, Andy. Just down the road, obviously.
Yes.
And a grey, lovely Monday morning.
On the shores of beautiful Loch Ness, though.
On the shores of beautiful Loch Ness, yeah. It's lovely to look out on, and the lambs are out on the fields. So
yes. As it turns, more and more green with algae bloom and all the problems that we know about, yes.
Not talking about that, Andy.
Yeah, let's not talk about that. Okay. Let's move it on. And anyway, for listeners, may well know Joe. Joe was the host of Helpful, co-host of Helpful Social Work podcast with Jerry Nosovska. Jerry's been on the podcast a number of times. Joe, this is your first time. You've just finished that though, haven't you? That's come to an end.
We have. We've handed it over, actually, to Chantelle and Sylvia from the anti-racist movement, and they're going to be taking it on. So keep listening, new fresh voices.
Yes, and that's, I think, Dr. Chantelle Thomas, Dr. Sylvia Smith, both of whom have been on this podcast, both of whom are fantastic individuals. So yes, I was really interested that you've kind of passed the torch on, transferred the brand, essentially. The podcast isn't finishing, it's just new hosts. That was really exciting, yeah.
Yeah, we're really pleased.
Wonderful. Well, listen, let's get into the conversation for today. I'm really keen to know, first of all, you guys are all independent social workers. Not everybody will be aware of the roles, because it's not a single role, the many, many roles that independent social workers undertake. Can we start with each of you telling me just a little bit about your background in social work and how you began working as an independent social worker?
So I've always practiced with children and their families, and I obtained my degree in Australia, came over here 2001, worked for local authorities, had a child, was never at home the same time as he was awake, and started to think maybe I could do this differently. And that's what started my journey into independent social work.
And when did you, so you're 23 years in the UK, Joe, when did you start as an independent? When did you push out and do that?
Yeah, probably when Ethan was about, I was trying to work this out, probably about 15 years ago, but I was doing part-time in a local authority and doing independent work. And probably 12 years ago, I started my business proper.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Gareth, how about you?
My background is within criminal justice, so in Northern Ireland, probation, thankfully, still retain a social work qualification to work within the probation service. So I started off there about 25 years ago and worked initially for about 15 years, just specialising in sexual and domestic abuse, so carried caseloads and worked a lot of the early intervention programs and became involved with the development of the public protection arrangements there. And then around 2015, I took up a position in New Zealand. And it was really whilst I was there for about 2 years, but I began to recognise that I had a sort of highly sought after skill set and knowledge base that maybe I hadn't recognised before. So on the back end of that, I came back and began to work independently back in Northern Ireland and across jurisdictions as well, into the Republic of Ireland and throughout the UK.
You were briefly with Baswood Northern Ireland as well. We were colleagues. Was I the final straw, Gareth, that made you think I can't work in an organisation anymore? I have to step out?
You were the one that put me over the edge. I couldn't take any more collegial chats, Andy, so I had to spend more time on my own.
Yes.
And I was very fortunate, Baswell acted as a sort of buffering or cushion for me just as I went independently. It was a part-time role came up with Baswa and I as a professional development officer. So
wonderful. And Michelle, when did you begin? Well, when did you begin your social work career and when did you become an independent?
Began my social work career around 2000. And I've worked mainly in children's services, children and families, one sort of another, I guess predominantly in fostering and adoption, kinship care, so family placement work, and became independent about just over seven years ago. And yeah, really because I sort of got to the stage where it felt like the roles that I was in at that point weren't using any of my social work skills. So it was a way of kind of, doing what I thought I was good at rather than what my job was defining. So, yeah.
Okay. Now let's explore what the roles entail, because social work is such a broad profession, covers so many different areas. So my presumption is independent social work is as broad as social work is in general. I was keen to learn just first of all about assessments and evaluations, the role that independents will perform in relation to conducting assessments and evaluations. Is that your area, Gareth? Is that your area, Michelle? Is that something you can talk about?
It's a part of my work. I suppose within that role of what you have a specialist skill set around sexual abuse or domestic abuse, local authorities, children's services agencies look for that expertise and look for an independent lens to view those cases or families that they're maybe stuck getting a decision or a pathway out of. And the independent then is brought in really to carry out that specialist assessment and provide some degree of clarity or recommendations going forward for the agency. So that for me, that focus has been very much around those areas around protectiveness, parental protectiveness and sexual risk and domestic abuse risk. But for others, it would be different.
Yes, yeah, similarly sort of brought in where things have been a bit more complex. So I guess where I think I'm brought in as an independent to do assessments, it's not everything that I do has been where adoptions or long-term permanent fostering placements have broken down and trying to kind of work out what we can learn from it, what went wrong, what we can maybe do better. So I guess that's where I would say I'm brought in. So it's very separate from the people who are quite involved and I guess emotionally impacted and trying to navigate a way through that.
So you talked about complexity, Gareth. You talked about bringing clarity to situations. Is it a case that you're kind of one step removed from the social workers who are delivering the services? Because what I was kind of curious to know, is it a case that there's a lack of expertise? So you have specialisms that you come in. Is there anything to be said about, are organisations seeking to pass responsibility for tough decisions on to others? Is that part of it or is that wrong?
No, ultimately the organisation themselves have to make that decision. For me, the assessments that I would conduct is very much about giving them the evidence and the defensibility in order to make their conclusions or make their decisions. It's not that we're removing the decisions from them, but it ensures that defensibility is there and there's an evidence base to inform that, which is fair to all parties. Ultimately, in my assessments, the aim is obviously to keep children and others safe. The evidence there allows social services, for example, to take those decisions.
Yeah, I would agree. I don't think it's about not wanting to take decisions. I think it's about the time and space to kind of step outside something and look at things and ask the right questions that aren't impacted by, you know, resources or time. I think that's an interesting question. About expertise, I think particularly in family placement work, there is, I would say there's a sort of thought process that is a bit of an easy area of work to go into, and I think it's really complex, and I think sometimes there is a real lack of expertise. So I think it's bringing some of that in, but also just space and time and giving people the opportunity to unpick things and learn. And I'm always really keen to do that without blame or shame, because I don't think that helps anybody learn from situations. So I think that's a real skill of independence, actually, to try and kind of offer a learning opportunity that isn't scary and blaming for people.
Yeah, I would love if somebody could give me one example of when blaming or shaming actually helped anyone learn Absolutely. Anything. Sorry, rhetorical question. But staying with that theme of expertise, I'm keen to know more about the role that independents can play as expert witnesses. Now, Gareth, this, I believe, is very much your area. Is that a role you perform?
Yeah, part of the role would be very much about carrying out those assessments, either on behalf of the courts or on behalf of any commissioning agency. And further afield into other review bodies as well. Within expert witness in courts, it was an initial challenge for social work to be accepted, particularly by family courts, as an expert witness. I think traditionally they would have looked towards the likes of psychology or other disciplines for that expertise. But I think over the last 10 years or so, there's been increasing acceptance and understanding that social workers who are coming in with a comprehensive understanding of, for example, families and risk are better placed in order to make those informed decisions to help courts and help other agencies make those decisions. So it's been a challenge, you know, and I remember on a couple of the first occasions being in the box and very much being, you know, challenged on your experience, your history, your reported expertise, and you have to put that across to the court, and the court has to determine whether or not you reach that criteria as an expert witness. So it can be a daunting experience, but you have to have the history and the expertise to back that up, and which is right, and it's right that the courts hold you accountable for that, because ultimately you're there to advise and guide them on really tricky decisions and difficult, challenging outcomes.
And Gareth, is there specific areas of practice where the role of independents as expert witnesses tends to be more prevalent?
I would say probably sexual, domestic violence, general violence would be requested from the courts. So, you know, I have over 25, 30 years experience in that field. The training that I received within probation was exceptional, and I've continued with that CPD onwards. So they're really looking towards those individuals with a proven track record in that area. And it's probably one of the areas that has been neglected historically by, for example, social services or other agencies. And I don't want to use a sort of corporate term, but maybe there's been a bit of a gap in the market of expertise in that area. And the courts then look towards people like myself in this role to advise and guide them on that.
What about consultation and training of other social workers? How much of your work is focused on that? Do you believe that's an area you're pretty experienced in?
Yes, this is actually where all my work is focused okay. on. So, yeah, I started off consulting with Heidi Cleaver on the assessment framework when I first came over just as a social worker, and I think that kind of led to an interest in the difference between the gap between all the research and what was happening on the ground in practice. And so the things that I do as an independent social worker is really try and close that gap. And I do think it's an important area for independent social workers to be able to do, because we bring that practice experience, but we can also read the research. We have the time to. I think a lot of our colleagues, unfortunately, don't have the time that they would want unless it's deliberately protected for them in these CPD sessions. So that's kind of became my passion, really.
And what sort of areas then? Can you give us some examples of the training you are delivering?
Sure. So I started off just, you know, a local authority would ask me, can you come and do 2 days on assessment work or 2 days on planning? You know, everyone thinks that, or everyone used to think that social workers couldn't analyse. And so there was all this, you know, can you come and teach them analysis? And what I kind of realised over time was that it's not that they can't do analysis, it's that the spaces and the places that are created for them and the pressure of the work is such that actually they need space to step out to do that analysis work.
Yeah, let's not go down a rabbit hole, but I'm dead keen to know the difference between assessment and analysis. You know, social workers are assessing day in, day out, and surely key to assessment is analysing the information in front of you. Tell us.
Yeah, I think I think that what I was being told and what people were feeling and what you see when you do audits is lots of descriptions sometimes, so not coming to a conclusion. You know, how Gareth and Michelle were talking about that kind of expertise and bringing that judgment confidently to a piece of work, sometimes that didn't happen as well. And like I said, you know, my theory after a decade of working with very talented peers is that actually often they don't have the time and space to do that thinking, because it's hard work to do that proper thinking. I'm sure Michelle and Gareth would agree that, you know, coming to good conclusions, doing good analysis on complex cases takes a lot of thinking time.
No, absolutely. Particularly when you're formulating and trying to understand an individual's behaviour and circumstances in order to bring some predictability to future behaviour, that takes a lot of time, and there's a lot of connection that needs to be made between patterns of behaviour stretching back over prolonged periods of time, which fortunately, as an independent, you have more time because you're probably working with one or two cases at any given moment in time in a very in-depth way, whereas as a social worker or as a probation officer, you have caseloads of 20, 30, 40, 50 cases, and you just don't have that time. You just don't have that ability to reflect, to consider the behaviour with that degree of formulated analysis. So I think that fundamentally becomes something that's appealing in those complex cases to those commissioning agencies, because they can get that real clear understanding of why somebody's behaved in a particular way in the past and what that means for their future behaviour.
Yeah, I suppose I was just thinking as you were both talking there that's why I always come back to the sort of no blame, no shame when I'm unpicking something that's gone wrong, because it is a real kind of luxury to work in this way, I think. And if I look back to my days of being employed, you're so kind of entrenched and pulled in so many different directions that, you know, I would have done similar things and made similar decisions based on all the kind of circumstances and conditions that you're working in. So I think, you know, there's the expertise, but I think there's also the sort of value base of coming to it with a kind of an awareness that it's a very different working environment to be a kind of employed social worker. So I do believe that everybody's doing their best at that moment in time, and it's, you know, a kind of luxury. And if people have the opportunity to unpick some of that afterwards, it can be really great learning experience, but always with that sort of understanding of nobody's deliberately getting things wrong.
If you just loop back a little bit, because I was originally talking about training, is there a risk that as an independent, that if you're training other social workers, you know, you could render your own role kind of superfluous? Your expertise is being shared with others. Is there a point at which you could actually do yourself out of a job?
Not with the turnover that there is in social work, unfortunately. Okay. And you know, the thing is, what I was kind of saying in the last bit was really the thing about training in our workforce, CPD, is that what you're doing is you're actually creating safe spaces that allow people to kind of take their bridle off and actually sit and think about their own expertise and reflect. When, you know, Gareth said earlier when he was in New Zealand, he started to realise all the skills and expertise he had. I think great learning environments allow the workers to get back in touch with their own expertise and go, oh, yeah, and their value base as well, and go, oh, this is what we're doing, this is why we're doing it. And that's why this is such a passion for me, doing this learning, because it's that opportunity to create that space. And I don't think that social workers in the current way that social work is run in local authorities will ever not need those opportunities, regardless of the level of expertise they have.
And so the question is just thinking then, if Gareth took himself to New Zealand, realised in that space, in that different context, he had specialist skills and expertise, you weren't so aware of that when you were in Northern Ireland, Gareth, would it be preferable that those skills and expertise were better realised by employers and staff were given the time to actually do that more in-depth work, better supported to do that, as opposed to having independents come in? Or would there always be a role for independents, even in a sort of perfect world situation where organisations properly supported and provided time to staff?
There's a lot of questions in that.
I know. I was kind of making up as going along, but you know, you can. You're a clever guy. You can pull that apart.
Okay, I'll pull it apart. I think the points that Joe was making is very, very valid for me and my experiences when I went to New Zealand. So I remember thinking, you know, I had the expertise because this organisation had come to me and offered me a position. And I thought, I'm coming out here to tell everybody how it's done. And very, very quickly, you realise that in a different context, in a different environment, in a different part of the world, whilst you have a knowledge base, etc., and you get time to reflect on that, you're also comparing and contrasting and learning from other people's experiences. So there's training and continuous professional development by that extension of yourself into new sort of challenging environments. And I think, as I mentioned before, the training that I received as a probation officer, as a manager within probation in that specialist area was second to none. I think it's only when you step outside of the maelstrom of firefighting and working with cases and multiple cases, which are incredibly complex, that you get time to reflect on the depth of knowledge and skills that you have. And I think the two came together just when I was in the Southern Hemisphere at a time when New Zealand were introducing legislation around their notification requirements for sexual offenders. So it was just a sort of, for me, this coming together of various events that allowed me to recognise what knowledge base I had. I think within organisations, there is a real challenge to allow people and professionals to step back, to reflect, to consider. Certainly, you know, we're preaching to the choir when we're saying we need more resources, we need more staff and boots on the ground to carry cases and have a much more in-depth relational-based approach with those cases that allows more informed decisions and a clear pathway for those families or individuals that you're working with. And I think that enables learning, I think that enables development, and I think it's a better outcome for the service user as well.
Thanks, Gareth. Now, I just want to move on a little bit. I can see we're all at home. I'm at home, Michelle's at home, Joe's at home, Gareth's at home, working from home. I presume as independents you do work from home. How does that affect your work-life balance? Is it easier to maintain a healthy work-life balance as an independent? We know how much pressure staff are under when they're working for local authorities, for example. Do you find it easier to separate work and life? Do you find it easier to kind of blend work and life in a healthy way?
I would say there's sort of two parts to the question, and sorry to bring it up, but the pre-COVID and post-COVID way of being an independent. And when I left employment, everybody said to me, do you not miss being part of a team? And my answer was, I now am a part of about 12 or 15 teams because I have sort of organisations that I regularly work for. So I didn't feel that at all. And this little office that I'm sitting in now was built with a view to popping in here at the end of a day when I was travelling all over Scotland, because that's what independent work meant to me at that point, was I was all over Scotland. Post-COVID, it became Zoom and Microsoft Teams. So it did have a very different feel to it, and that's taken a bit of adjustment. And I feel like now it's much more of a kind of balance of sometimes, you know, out in organisations again, but still a lot more at home. But in terms of work-life balance, then you know you're flexible. It's hard work getting your business up and running. That takes a lot of time. but I would say there's absolutely no way it compares to full-time work in a kind of really challenging organisation. I think partly because you're working, you can choose to work to your skill set, you can choose what you take on and what you don't. Although, you know, first few years you're saying yes to everything, frightened that the work stops, but actually it doesn't. But yeah, it's much more within your own control, I think.
Just on that, I imagine it's important to say yes to the right things, no to the wrong things. You're not going to build much of a brand for yourself if you're saying yes to the wrong things. Absolutely. And not delivering. Yeah. Gareth, Joe, what do you think?
I think it does depend what kind of independent business you build. When I was solo, then I think it was much easier to manage work-life balance. But, you know, I had I'm pre-COVID, post-COVID story as well. I had 12 employees pre-COVID. And that meant that really I was responsible for a lot of people's livelihoods. And so my work-life balance pretty much went out the window because I was delivering as well as managing other social workers, making sure they got their supervision and doing all the training and that stuff. So that got to be quite a big workload, really. But then post-COVID, we made the decision to, it was a nice, for some people it was a nice pause, you know, for others it was terrible. But we've made the decision to go back to a much simpler model. And so, but I still have an office, so I still go out to the office. I still have a set of colleagues that I work with. But my work-life balance is much better now. And I think it's things like you can take Tuesday off if you want to do exercise class, or you can work on Saturday morning and that's okay. You have much more ability to manage your workload than you do, I think, in these very busy environments.
That's great. That's really helpful to understand. What about marketing yourself as an independent? I know if I was in your role, this is something I'd really struggle with. Maybe it's an Irish thing, I don't know. But kind of it's not about confidence and ability, but it's about, I suppose, speaking up and saying, hands up me, I'm going to do this work. How do you find that marketing yourself as a consultancy, as a brand, as an independent?
Initially, I found it very difficult, and maybe it's the same, tall poppy syndrome, Andy.
Don't get a big head. Don't believe in your ability.
But ultimately, your livelihood depends on you putting yourself out there, so... initially, when I started, it was just reputation that was giving me additional work. But then I started to branch out into other areas and beginning to apply that skill set and knowledge that I spoke about into areas that traditionally I hadn't been involved in. And ultimately, you have to be able not to convince commissioners or other agencies or others about your ability to take on the role, but certainly breed a confidence in them. And that comes with pitches, ultimately, being able to put yourself forward and say yes to things where normally, you know, you would have been struggling maybe to say, I can do that. But you quickly realise, you do have adaptable skills. You do have an adaptable knowledge base that can be equally applicable in other fields and other industries, and that's resulted that, you know, I've ended up working, you know, with Premier Sport and Regulation Authorities and organisations with government bodies looking at policy and practice and introducing public protection arrangements. And again, you need to put yourself out there. You need to stand up at the conferences. You need to produce your research papers. You need to produce your whatever assessment frameworks that people are developing, etc., and really put your mark on the market and not be led by other people's thinking, you know, or other people's dogma very much. And that drove me in many areas of my own work, which was really to develop my own thinking, my own practice, and have an influence which I felt would be of benefit to people and other organisations.
Thanks, Gareth. Joe, Michelle, how about you guys in terms of marketing yourselves? Is that something you struggle with, or is it something you're naturally very confident with?
Rubbish, actually, for quite some time. I still tend to do word of mouth, and I guess my podcast was one of my main ways. But I do believe that it's important to pick a thing you feel comfortable with and then to work at it. Like if you like to produce papers or frameworks, or if you like to produce a blog, or if you're a person who uses LinkedIn, or I think, you know, pick your strength and then say to yourself, this is part of my job. So every week I need to attend to that thing. I think that that's helpful.
I would say much the same. I wouldn't say that, I wouldn't say marketing's a strength, but I also, I don't know if Scotland's quite small, but it's very much been reputation, word of mouth, and working to your strengths. One of the things I do a lot of is kind of chairing complex meetings, panels, disruptions, those kind of things. And yeah, you kind of get known for those things, I suppose. So I wouldn't say that I've done a whole lot of marketing. It's been very much who I know. People have said, can you do? And as Gareth said, that's occasionally led to something kind of slightly different. But yeah, I'm not saying it's something that I'm, excuse me, particularly comfortable with, but it's also not something I've had to do a lot of either. And staying connected, I think staying connected is really important. You know, attending lots of relevant events and make, one of the things I was really worried about becoming independent was staying up to date with knowledge. So just making sure that you're involved in the kind of right things and still connected to the right people, I think is really important.
Well, if we look at that a bit more, Michelle, what are the ways that you ensure your CPD is up to date and that you're plugged in and you're getting updates in terms of legislation, policy development? How do you do that?
So staying involved with all the kind of people that I did before. So AFCA, which in Scotland, AFCA formed when BAF in Scotland ceased to exist. So I'm an associate of theirs, so get access to all of their
Sorry,
research.
Forgive me, what's AFCA? What's
AFCA
that?
Is the Adoption Fostering Alliance Scotland, AFCA, Adoption Fostering Kinship Alliance Scotland, used to be BAF, British Association of Adoption and Fostering, or was formed when that ceased to exist, I should say. So, you know, they're very much involved in kind of research and, you know, help me maintain my kind of knowledge and stay involved with them, get some supervision from them, stay connected with them. And also, the agencies that I'm involved with have been really lucky to be able to access training via them. So, yeah, just kind of staying connected to all of those relevant organisations, I guess.
What about you, Gareth?
Yeah, look, it's a continuous evolving field, so it's really, really important that we keep ourselves up to date with what's current and the research. So I would attend a lot of conferences. I would present at a lot of conferences. I'm chair within NOTA, which is the National Association for the Treatment of Abuse, which is very good in terms of maintaining up-to-date research, etc., and really continuing just to follow what is current, making sure that your assessment frameworks that you're using, your assessment models, etc., are the most up-to-date. I'm an associate of AIM, which is an organisation that assesses and provides interventions for young people engaged in harmful sexual behaviour. And again, there's a constant evolvement there of current and revised assessment and intervention frameworks. So that constantly challenges you. But again, it's the sense of, as Michelle was saying, getting the balance right, because as you're continuing with your CPD, you're not earning a wage or a salary. It's time set aside. So you have to recognise and build that into things like costing and the time allocated to your working week. But it is incredibly important. I don't think you can continue to practice with any degree of efficacy unless you're up to date.
Well, stuff like that, I'm kind of keen to explore that a little bit more. I mean, as an independent, you're essentially running a small business. So you're talking about, yes, costing in time, Gareth, for your CPD, things like that. What about things like just the business administration side of things, you know, billing, tax issues, auditing, for example? That's not stuff you're going to learn in your social work undergraduate course. Like, how have you kind of, are you figuring that out as you go? Is that something that BASWA supports you with?
Yeah, this has been something that's been really important for me. is managing all of that administration and understanding about PAYE and national insurance and all of that kind of stuff. And I have figured it out mostly as I've gone, but there is really good help actually at BASWA, and it's good to have the Independence Network. And it's and just I just talked to other people to start with who'd been doing it for longer than me. And there's really great websites out there to search it. So, you know, it's been a learning experience.
BASWA has an independence directory as well, don't they? If somebody's looking to contact an independent, are you guys all on that? Yeah.
Yeah. One of the really important things for me when I started was the SASWA, so the Scottish arm, had a group of independents who met regularly. And actually one of the most helpful inputs was exactly that. You know, how do you decide what your fees are going to look like, and how do you manage all of it? How do you build in those training days to your costs, etc.? Because nobody, you know, that's not stuff that, as you say, that you get in your social work career. So that was really helpful. And just having that network of other people doing not the same work, very different work sometimes, but in the same situation, trying to navigate way through finances and IT, and suddenly you don't have an administrator in your team that can fix all of those kind of IT issues. So all of that's been really helpful to have other people around.
I remember in an early job my boss saying, you know, every business runs on its administration and how capable it is. So yes, if you're an independent and you're not very good at that, that's going to be a challenge for sure. In terms of potential drawbacks though, I mean, there are problems when you are an employee. You know, you're not your own boss. You might have a great boss, you might have a terrible boss, but you have a boss and you know you're going to get paid at the end of the month. Is that a challenge as an independent, not having that stability? Have there been times when things have been financially difficult? Have there been times when you're not sure if you're going to have enough contracts coming in?
I have to say that that's not been my experience. It's been a constant worry that that is going to happen. But I know from all of the independents in Scotland that I'm connected with that there's not enough of us, and we're always kind of sharing work in terms of somebody's approach to me, I can't do it, can somebody else do it? So it's not been an issue for me. I would say the only thing that I had to get my head around when I first started was you need a good 4 to 6 months space at the beginning, you know, a kind of financial back end, because getting those new contracts up and running takes time. So you might not get any kind of finances coming through for a good few months because you've got to go through all of those sort of processes. But once that's up and running, it's not been my experience. But I guess everybody's circumstances are different. You just have to be aware of that. But I'd say there's definitely plenty of work around.
Gareth, what I saw you nodding your head at the start when I asked that question. How's your experience been?
Yeah, I would agree with Michelle in that it's really important to have, you know, a number of contracts going at any one given moment in time. I think for me, it's been really important to diversify and not to just do the one thing like assessments or reports, for example. Beginning to expand your portfolio into other areas ensures that you've got a rolling program of work, which is important, because you can get hit with anything down the track. COVID, needless to say, came left field for everybody. I remember the day that Boris Johnson took to its TV, and I had 6 months worth of work that then I spent the next day or two just wiping out of my diary because it was just cancelled overnight. And the concept of Zoom or Teams was completely alien to me. So it was something that you just had to respond to and evolve and develop. And I think that's really my experience is that it instilled further resilience and a further commitment that if you can get through something like that and adapt and evolve, fundamentally you can get through everything. But it is, you know, it is a worry, particularly if somebody was to come out of paid employment, knowing that they're getting their salary at the end of every month, their sick pay and their pension, etc. All of that's gone when you become independent. So you have to plan for that. You have to cost that in. You have to take cognizance of the occasions when you'll get sick, a family member will get sick, an event will happen like COVID or anything else, and that has to be planned for as best you can, but ultimately these curveballs exist for you, so it is important that you have that consequential thinking head on, as any business owner should have, and begin to think about contingencies for those events.
Now, I know nobody goes into social work for the money. It'd be a strange decision to make if you did, but I am keen to know about the extent to which opportunities to increase earning potential fed into decisions to become independent. You know, you talked about freedom, you know, the benefits of being your own boss, choosing the work you get to do. Is anybody willing to talk about money? You know, have you earned more as an independent than you would have done as an employee? How's that compared?
It's a very rude question, Andy.
I was a wee bit awkward asking that question, but I've asked it now, so there, it's out there.
It wasn't a reason to go into independence. It certainly was more of a worry than a reason to enter into the work. But from the outside in, people may say, and are getting invoiced for pieces of work and think that's a significant amount of money. But, and I'm not crying here, but when you break all this down in terms of, you know, your running costs, you have an office in the house, your running costs, your administration costs, I employ other people. I employ associate teams for pieces of work. I've got my national insurance, I've got my pension, I've got my sick pay all incorporated into that. So whilst the initial sort of invoice that comes into a commissioner might seem that's quite expensive, and is that what you earn as an independent? The reality of that one gets broken down is into a salary that I, as an independent, take from my company. So I'm an employee of my own company, and I take a salary from that as dividends, etc. So no, it's not all sunshine and roses, Andy. Absolutely not.
You're not turning up in a helicopter every time you do an assessment, Gareth. No,
that's Steve Jobs, yeah.
No, but I mean, it's an interesting one, because, you know, when we think about, as employees, you think about what comes into your bank every month. You're not thinking about the pension contributions your employer makes, the office costs that they'll cover, national insurance, all that stuff. Yeah, but thanks very much for addressing that. I appreciate it. Now, we did talk earlier on about work-life balance and working from home. We kind of touched on this a little bit, but I'm keen to know about the issue of isolation. Imagine working independently could become particularly isolating. You know, is that something you've had to deal with? Have you enjoyed that, the space? Joe, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, I was just thinking about the fact that I was working by myself as a sole trader, and I was sometimes co-teach with another person, Jerry Nasowska. And when we would get together, we would just talk about everything we were thinking about, the latest legislation that had come out, whatever, you know, and we'd be, what's this, what's that? And out of that, we developed a habit of talking regularly, and that turned into our podcast, Helpful Social Work, because we decided we had topics we wanted to explore, we wanted to keep current, we had things we wanted to share with people, and we were hoping to start a conversation with a group of people, really reach out and go, what do you guys think about this? This is what we're thinking sitting here. And that was 8 years we did that for.
That's a long time. Yes. Yeah. And you've decided to finish that. So what's going to replace that then?
Well, exactly. This is really interesting. So I've got myself a supervisor now who works in a local authority. So she's able to kind of give me that connection to a local authority. And we meet once a month. And I also take coaching. So I receive coaching. And they're the two ways I'm trying, but I'm thinking of different things as well. I think Michelle talked earlier about that need to stay connected. And I think that's so important. And I'm now back working regularly in different authorities as well. And like you say, you kind of become a bit of their team as well, don't you? So you get that, yeah.
Does everyone have a requirement with the regulator to have professional supervision?
Yeah.
Yes. How does that work?
So I do get supervision from one of the agencies that I'm an associate of, but also because I do things like chair panels for those particular authorities. I'll have appraisals and supervision, etc. So I probably am more supervised and appraised than I've ever been, to be honest.
Listen, I've got one last question to ask before we finish. Thank you so much for your time, everybody. Would you ever go back to be an employee for a big organisation or any organisation? Or are you too much in love with being your own boss?
I mean, I absolutely love what I do now, and I feel really lucky to have been able to kind of carve out that space for myself. But as we've talked about already, if it all sort of ended tomorrow, then absolutely I would. I think the joy of social workers, there's so many different jobs. So if I needed to, then I would. But if I was able to continue working on my own, I would stay that way.
Gareth, what about you?
Would I go back? Quick answer, no. Would they have me back is the second part of that. I think the two sit, just the points that Joe and Michelle were making, the two sit across each other. I actually don't feel isolated in my role, because you build relationships with other agencies, other organisations and colleagues within those agencies. A lot of my work would stretch over years working within an agency. And I enjoy that. I enjoy the variety of contact that we can make. I enjoy being exposed to other organisations and other countries and other parts of the world. So I don't think I would get that if I was confined within an organisation, working solely within that organisation with a limited scope. I just think, as an independent, running your own business, you have this huge reach. If you want to have that huge reach, you can develop that, and that's incredibly appealing to me, because, as I say, you can grow and continue to grow. I constantly feel that I'm evolving, and I think I've hugely evolved from working in one organization for a long period of time. The 10 years since I've been independent, I've been exposed to so much, and I think that has really helped me grow.
Thanks, Gareth. And Joe, what about you?
I think I'm in a slightly different position maybe to everybody else. I think I might be the oldest here. And so I'm at my last 5 years of my career, really. And I'm thinking that I'd like to go back into direct practice.
Oh, really?
Direct work, actually. Wow. Yeah, I am. Because I've really missed it. And I've missed it more over the coming years. So that's something that I'm looking at and thinking about, come the end of this year.
Gareth, Joe, Michelle, thank you so much for coming on to Let's Talk Social Work. Hopefully not for the last time. It's been great spending some time with you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.